So this is Sharon Bushell. I am interviewing Marilyn Leland, and today is June 29th. So just in case that doesn't work, we have Old Faithful here. Okay.
Redundancy is good.
So Marilyn Leland on the 29th of June. So Marilyn, other than having met you the day that I met
Stan
and
John.
Right, John. Right. How can I forget that? I don't know anything about what where you were or what you were doing when the Exxon Valdez hit Bly Reef.
Okay.
So why don't you just tell me about that part?
Okay. Well, I was the executive director of the Cordova District Fishermen United, which was the group that was in Cordova commonly referred to as the Fishermen's Union, although it really wasn't a union. It strictly is more of a trade association. By that time, it had been a union in, you know, earlier history, but mm-hmm. I had been there since 1986. And so when the spill happened, I was home in bed, mm-hmm. and I got a phone call about 6:30 in the morning from Jack Lamb, who was the vice president of the board, and he had heard from somebody outside of Alaska that there had been a spill, and so he called me to inform me, and I got up and got dressed quickly and went to the office and started making phone calls. So.
Wow. Was it entirely unexpected, or?
Well, no. It's something that the CDFU had historically been critical of oil spill response plans that Alyeska had. And we had at times made comments on it, but there really, back in those days before the spill, there wasn't a real good mechanism for giving input into those things, even though they obviously ended up having a huge impact on us. And of course, and I'm sure you've heard this story the night before the spill, Ricky Yacht, who was also on our board at that time, had a teleconference with the mayor's group over in Valdez, and I mean, the quote that she has most oftenly been quoted on is, it's not if there's an oil spill, it's when there's an oil spill. And so it wasn't totally unexpected. The other thing, too, actually, interestingly, after the spill, going back again in history, and of course, much of, before 86, all of this happened before I even lived, you know, in Alaska, and so this, I'm just repeating what I've heard.
Uh-huh.
But CDFU was one of the groups that fought to block the pipeline from even coming into Valdez. Huh. And then Congress went to Congress. Well, actually, they won in court. There was a court case, and they won in court. So then it went to Congress to change the law, and it came to a tie vote in Congress, and Spiro Agnew cast the deciding vote, and it was by that one vote that the terminal was in Valdez. But so CDFU had, you know, historically been opposed to it, and they were very concerned about mm-hmm. the possibility of an oil spill. But after the spill, we knew that we had a lot of old records from back in those days in the basement of the Union Hall, and so I brought somebody, actually it was a previous executive director, Jeannie Buller, I brought her on board to have her literally go through the basement and see what she could find. And one of the things that she came up with was there was a transcript of a congressional hearing that happened back when Congress was considering this, and it was a congressional hearing that was held in Alaska. And there was a commercial fisherman who then, even still then, lived in Cordova, and in 89 still lived in Cordova, and was still actively fishing. And he testified before that committee. And he used an example of 100,000 barrels, or no, 200,000 barrels at Blind Reef as being a possible oil spill. And the response to that at that time was, well, it couldn't possibly happen, and if it did, we would be prepared to clean it up. Well, I have to say, when I came across that transcript, it gave me chills, because it's like, well, that was rather prophetic.
Yeah, I should say.
Yeah.
Wow.
So no, I guess we always sort of, hoped it would never come, and I also don't think any of us really had any idea of the sheer magnitude that it would be when it did come. I certainly didn't. You know, I think initially I thought, well, this is, you know, we're going to be busy with this for a little while. Well, it's, you know, 18 years later, and lots of people are still busy with it.
Right.
So
I've been told snippets about the chaos in Cordova, but what was it like from your perspective as a citizen, and also from the point of view of the position that you held?
Well, I would say it was a somewhat organized chaos. I mean, it really wasn't chaos. It was very, very busy. And, you know, a lot of unanswered questions. And I mean, I think, you know, in the first 3 days, you know, like I said, when I first got the word, I went into the office and just literally started making phone calls, calling the Coast Guard, calling Alyeska, calling Exxon, calling DEC, calling anybody I could possibly think of to try to, you know, number one, confirm that it had happened, and number two, then find out, you know, how bad it is, you know, and really, was there anything that we could do? Almost immediately, we had fishermen, you know, as soon as the word got out on the street, we had fishermen coming into the office, and they wanted to go out and help.
Right.
And initially, in the earliest days, I really felt that the attitude was one neighbor helping another neighbor because they've got a problem. Money wasn't even brought up at all. And you know, when I would talk to different people, tell them we had boats, and I would say the most memorable conversation for me was I was with someone at Alyeska, and I don't anymore even remember who it was. It wasn't somebody I knew at the time. I suspect I probably know them pretty well now, but I've forgotten who it was. But when I told them that, you know, we had all of these boats, they said to me, well, we can't afford the liability of using amateurs. And my response to them was, the amateurs are the people who've just flown in from Houston. I said, I'm talking about fishermen who have spent their entire lives, you know, out in Prince William Sound, you know, hauling seines, hauling gill nets. Trust me, they are not amateurs, and they are perfectly capable of doing this.
That's sort of, but that attitude sort of sets up the whole, I'm just hearkening back to thinking of that long, involved conversation with Tom Copeland, which was, whoa, so compelling, interesting, and everything. But, boy, it just seems like of all the communities, of all the people and efforts, the people of Cordova really got dealt a bad hand in that deal. Did they know it at the time? I mean,
well,
I don't even know how to phrase that question.
Yeah.
But I think you know what I
don't.
I mean.
I don't think initially. I mean, certainly we knew it was a disaster. You know, we knew it was a terrible thing. I don't think it really sunk in. It certainly didn't to me, anyway. It took a long time for it to sink in, you know. Although it was so frustrating in the beginning, there just, you know, just coming up against stone walls of people not even being willing to talk to me, and especially when we had these incredible resources, which of course now are all part of the system. You know, I mean, we've gone so far beyond that, But it was finally, it was Denny Kelso, who was then the commissioner of DEC, who, I think it was about 3 days into the spill, my phone rang, and it was Denny on the phone, and he says to me, I hear you got some boats down there. And I said, yeah, we sure do. And he says, well, how many could you get for me? And I said, right now I got 100 on my list. And he said, well, could you have 3 of them there in the morning? And I said, yeah, we can do that. And that was what broke open the door, and the fishermen did go over there. Unfortunately, that was when the weather turned. You know, we'd had really good weather up until then. That was right.
Must have been day four.
Yeah, that was right when the weather turned bad. And so, I mean, they got over there, but I know they weren't able to do much initially. However, again, that is what broke it open, so that the industry folks and the government folks did see that we had this resource and that there were a lot of fishermen who could help.
Right. Yeah. So, considering the the absence of email back in those days, the necessity of fax machines and so forth. I'm just envisioning people converging on your office.
Well, that's true. In fact, let me say something about the fax machine, too, because obviously there wasn't email. Well, in Cordova, there were barely fax machines. I think back in those days, there were maybe a half a dozen fax machines in the entire town, and we didn't have one of them.
I know Margie Johnson went to town and bought one.
Yeah. Well, and we went and got one at CDFU as well, but when it happened, for a few weeks after that, we didn't have one. And we only had three telephone lines, and of course, every time you hung up one, the phone, it would immediately ring, and calls were coming in from all over the world. And the Union Hall really became the gathering place for local people. I mean, literally, it's a big old building, and there's mm-hmm. We had a small office in the back, mm-hmm. and the aquaculture, Prince William Sound Aquaculture, had their office right next door to us, and we owned the building, but we actually had the smallest office there. But then the very front part was what's called the Union Hall, and it was an area where we would have meetings, and mm-hmm. But any given time that I'd walk through out there, there'd be 50 fishermen hanging out, and it was sort of the place where the people were coming to get the information.
Now, that's a scene that I was never able to quite frame the question for Tom, but that scene that you're talking about, 50 fishermen who are not allowed to fish or to help on the spill cleanup, what was the climate like? What was that like in there? I mean, I'm thinking of just a lot of strong language, but...
Yeah. Well, it was a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, with fishermen, there's often a lot of strong language, so that's... No, I'm not sure that I could segregate that out, but it was very emotional. I remember walking through there and seeing, these big old guys, and I'm talking about guys who'd been there, their whole lives, and, maybe, 50, 60 years old at that point, and literally would see them with tears in their eyes.
Yeah.
And it was a feeling of helplessness. Yeah. Of course, once there was a downside to opening the door and getting the boats in and responding, and I'm sure you've heard about this too, that there were sort of the haves and have-nots. And there were fishermen who were able to get contracts. There were fishermen who didn't want to get contracts. They did not want to work for Exxon. And then there were fishermen who wanted to work for Exxon but couldn't get a contract. So it did create a lot of animosity between some people. I mean, some people who thought you shouldn't go to work for Exxon would be mad at the people who did go to work for Exxon.
So in what case would it be that somebody wanted to but couldn't? How?
Well,
in what case would they be mad at that?
I've heard allegations, and there are people who thought there was some favoritism going on. I don't know that of my own accord. I don't. Who knows? Or maybe their equipment. Choices were
inferior
made.
Inferior equipment, or they may have mouthed off at some point.
Or maybe at that point, maybe at the point that they were trying to get in there, they just simply weren't needed. See, that's the other thing. In the earliest days of the oil spill, there wasn't enough equipment to go out and respond to the spill. So, it didn't help. If you had a boat out there, but you actually didn't have the boom to haul.
Yeah.
And they were running out of space in the containers. I mean, they had the skimmers out, but they didn't have storage space to put what they were picking up. So a lot of things just, they were falling way behind on the skimming because they didn't have any place to put it.
Yeah.
So.
The way that Tom is really my point of reference here, he and Margie, they're so far to my knowledge, they're the only true Cordova people, even though I know that Tom is a on and off, but, and Joe Banda, he grew up in Cordova, but mm-hmm. It seems to me that the frustration must have been paramount, and was there much communication back and forth between Valdez in terms of like going, a person?
Yeah.
Does a person who lives in Cordova, do they do their shopping in Valdez?
No.
Or?
No, but let me, I will tell you what happened, though, is another thing that we can thank Denny Kelso for is, I don't, you know, this was in within a couple weeks afterwards. I don't remember the exact timing, but, it, you know, we first had the phone call on getting the votes. But then after that, he made two offers to me. One was DEC had an office in Valdez, and he said, we can put aside a small office for CDFU if you'd like to have somebody over here. So the woman who had been the previous executive director, Jeannie Buller, who I had brought in to go through the things in the basement,
right.
We hired her again, and she went to Valdez, and she ran that office over in Valdez. So we did have someone on site in Valdez. The other offer that Denny made me is they had... they were chartering their planes out of Cordova. So the planes were leaving Cordova every morning, going over to Valdez, picking up people, doing whatever it was they were doing throughout the day. And at the very end of the day, before sunset, they would come back to Cordova. And so Denny did say to me that, you know, if you need to come to Valdez, just be there in the morning, get on the plane, you can go over, spend the day in Valdez, and then you can come back that evening, which I did several times, and which was great because finding a place to stay in Valdez was impossible.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of what would be the next best question to ask you in amongst all of this.
Well, let me just kind of follow up on what the other question you were asking is just getting the information. In one way, we were very lucky that the previous October, there had been a group of us for a few years who had been trying to get a public radio station in Cordova. And ultimately, we decided to not do our own public radio station, but to get a repeater on the public radio station over in Valdez. And that actually happened in the October before the oil spill. So because of that, we were actually getting, you know, live feeds on press conferences and things like that. And otherwise, it would have been sort of a black hole of information. Yeah. The other thing, too, I'm getting confused here. We had invited... Exxon and a number of other people to come to Cordova for a press conference. And we had invited the press. And the answer we kept on giving was, well, the press is all in Valdez and there's going to be a press conference there and no, none of us can come. And we kept on getting stonewalled too by Exxon. Frankly, they didn't want to come. And we said, well, we're putting this on. Well, ultimately, and we told reporters that we were dealing with us, well, the story is going to be here at that point. So ultimately, this did come up. And we had, I think, probably about 1,500 people in the auditorium at the high school gym, which at that time of year is probably virtually every
right.
adult who can walk, you know.
Right.
And Exxon arrived late. They had chartered over. They arrived late, probably a good 45 minutes late. And the first thing that was announced was that they were going to have to leave early because their pilot's license was expiring. Well, I think what they really meant was he was going to have the requisite number of hours that he couldn't fly anymore. Well, there's lots of pilots in Cordova, lots of little planes in Cordova, and there were calls from all over the gym saying, I can give you a ride back. And, you know, it was real clear that they needed to stay. And I have to give them credit, they did stay. But up until that point, too, it's like, you know, we, at times, I really had the sense from Exxon that what was going on was really none of our business. And we should, you know, we didn't know anything about it, we should just stay out of it. You know, I mean, again, nobody actually said those words, but, you know...
They don't need to.
You know, they don't need to, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me what that meeting was like.
It was again, very emotional. You know, we had the CDFU board seated at the front. We had a table at the front, and all of us were seated up there at the front. And, you know, lots of questions from the audience. And it actually was March 28th. Was the date of it?
Because I was going to ask you.
Yeah, because I remember because it was Michelle O'Leary's birthday, and she was also on the board, and she was sitting next to me, and it was her birthday. Anyway, so that was just very soon after the oil spill.
Right.
But anyway, and of course that's also the one where Don Cornett, who was basically heading it up for Exxon in Alaska for the response on the spill, you know, his quote there was, you know, "You will be made whole." And then I remember another one there was talked about, there were some examples started to be given from the audience of, like, about the ski hill. Cordova's got, you know, a little ski hill. I mean, it's actually a reasonably challenging ski hill, but nonetheless, it's, you know, it's got a single place chairlift, and and it's run by a club, so it's a nonprofit. But it, you know, it's something that's important to the community.
Right.
Well, it had to close down because it didn't have anybody to run it, and so they, you know, and but they still had certain bills that they had to pay, that they needed the rest of that season for, and I mean, like the insurance, and of course the utility bills were still coming in, and things like that. And so that was an example given as, well, you know, this is a side effect, and this is only happening because of the spill. And I remember Cornett then saying, well, I don't really see how that could be compensable. So I'm sure it was an uncomfortable meeting for Exxon.
Yes. That just conjures up images of people being once again, angry and upset and shouting. Is that off the chart? I mean, is
no,
that
that's not off the chart.
Yeah,
and I think Cordova kind of has a reputation for being that way, frankly. Well, you know, and representing the fishermen at, you know, Board of Fish meetings and stuff like that. I mean, people would get up there, they'd speak their mind, they'd, you know, but I never saw anything out of line. This one, particularly, I think, had Exxon really decided to leave and actually try to leave early, I think they would have had a problem.
So I'm not putting words in your mouth here, but it's sort of, it's not unthinkable that this was not a threatening situation, but it might have been approaching that. They may have perceived that.
Well, I would say I would not at all be surprised if they perceived it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it's in part because I think Cordova has a little bit of a reputation in that way, but I think it's an unfair reputation myself.
Yeah.
I never actually saw it.
Yeah.
But, no, people were angry, you know, and especially because at that time, you know, by that point, you know, they were stonewalling us and really, you know, I mean, we had gotten a boat, you know, some boats over there through DEC, but Exxon was completely blocking us out. So yeah, there was a lot of anger there.
Yes. So how did the next how did that? What happened after the meeting? Did it change anything?
Well, in some ways, yeah, I think it did change some things because. Even though we weren't getting the answers that we wanted to get, I think that that Exxon did realize that they did need to include us, that we were part of it, and they did need to be communicating with us. And you know, ultimately, they assigned a person to handle Cordova. I don't know if that's a good word. DJ Moon, who is somebody I didn't know before, but he actually was a former Cordovan, but he was working for Exxon, and I don't know if he had been working for Exxon before that or not, but he was supposed to, and basically maybe liaison is a better word. And so, you know, he would come over and he would meet with us, and we fairly early on too, we formed an oil spill committee. The city council created this committee and appointed people representing, you know, different segments of the population. I was on the committee representing commercial fishing, you know, but we had processing, and we had the mayor was on it representing the city. The aquaculture people had a person on it. The churches had a person on it. So, I mean, it was really representing the, you know, broad spectrum of the community. And pulled that together. And actually, we ended up doing something that I didn't see coming out of any other communities. And it was we were doing a regular printed report that, you know, people, I think it was just, I can't remember, it was called the Oil Spill Report or something like that. But anyway, Nancy Bird ended up being the editor on that. And what we were trying to do was just get out the latest information so that people could come into the Union Hall. You know, it would be posted, but they could pick up copies. And so, you know, there were so many rumors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just rumors would be flying. And, you know, we were trying to just, you know, get what we knew to be the latest correct information. Mm-hmm. So, and, of course, then the other thing, too, that I think is one of the good things that came out of the spill was the RCAC.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved with that and the startup of that. And that, too, I think that's made a huge difference in the, you know, the communication between industry. I mean, it really is a different world now.
Yeah, that seems to be the one unarguable fact of the whole debacle. There's a question I want to ask you, Marilyn. In preparation, I'll be going toward the latter part of summer, I'll be going to Cordova.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I can't ask this question of the folks there, so you seem like a good person to ask. And that is, what about the factions as they were split, with people who would go to work for Exxon mm-hmm. and those who did not? How did that play out in the community?
Well, now some of this is going to be just what I heard about before the oil spill. And I mean, I think I heard this in the context of after the oil spill, but there had been a number of years before then, there had been a strike. And it was back when they were actually bargaining the prices, and there had been a strike. And there had been people who had fished, notwithstanding the fact that there was a strike. And so there was animosity there, and you had, you know, people very angry at each other and, you know, literally not speaking to each other.
Right.
Well, what I'm told is that after the spill, there were a number of interesting flip-flops on that of people, you know, who had been enemies because of that, but now they were not. On the other hand, I think it created new enemies. And I mean, the people were very angry. They had some very strong feelings about it. And I would say probably, well, the two groups, I mean, the group that actually got contracts and went off, I mean, I don't know that they were angry at anybody, unless maybe what was being said to them, probably, but the people that were the angriest were the ones who wanted to work and couldn't, and the ones who thought no one should.
Right.
You know, another thing on that note, too, that I'd like to say is there is a term coined that I've heard batted around more, well, not in Cordova, but more outside of Cordova, and actually even outside of Alaska, and that term is spillionaire.
Right.
Well, at one point when I was still at CDFU, I actually, you know, I mean, I had the numbers. I knew how many people were working and, you know, and making a lot of money. And certainly there were some people who made a lot of money. There's no question about it. But from the information, the data that I had, it looked to me like a third of the fleet probably made a lot of money. A third of the fleet probably made maybe close to what they might normally have made if they were fishing. And a third of the fleet wasn't making anything.
Keep thinking about Cordova. I've lived in Alaska for 30 years, and I've been to some of the native villages up north and to the west, and I always wanted to get down to Cordova to see Bobby Van Brocklin.
Oh, Bobby was a very good friend of mine.
Yeah, he was a childhood friend of mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, he just lived up the street. He was a year ahead of me in high school, but he dated my sister. And
was that in Anchorage? Or
in Port Angeles, Washington.
Oh, in Port Angeles. Oh, okay.
Yeah. We went to the same elementary school, same junior high.
Oh.
Yeah, so we were very good friends. Last time I saw him was in 1968 when he was on R&R from Vietnam. He came to Honolulu, where I was living with a couple of girls from high school. And his mother, Liz, met us there, and we had a great time, but I always wanted to get to Cordova to see Bob, but it was just so Cordova is not a place that you go to.
No, you don't get there by accident.
You just don't get there, and when you're around Anchorage, you meet people from here and there and all mm-hmm. over the place. You don't meet people from Cordova. I swear,
That's actually kind of interesting, because it seems to me, I mean, as a former Cordovan, and, mean, you know, I'm out and about in Anchorage, I'm always running into people who are still from Cordova.
Yeah.
You know, particularly go to Costco, you know, the usual sorts of places.
Right.
You know.
Well, when I was doing the that column for Anchorage Daily News mm-hmm. about the older Alaskans, Cordova was never a place that was even in my mind to go to because they never gave me any travel money.
Yeah.
So it was always any traveling that I did was all at my expense. So I could dream about those places. Although in the end, I did make telephone calls to people up in Barrow and so forth like that. But by that time, Bobby was gone and the draw was not there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would say back in those days, when it came to guys, Bobby was probably my best friend. I mean, as for guys, I had women friends who were probably better friends, but he and I were really good friends.
Well, let's return when the mics are off. We'll return to that.
Okay.
But in terms of the actual number of words that we're probably we'll be using, we've probably exceeded that now. But Stan just gave me the word today that we're probably around. Whereas I had been thinking of 2,500, he's thinking of 1,000.
Per story, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, after doing the column for ADN, I stood firm at 1,500. I didn't think you could shape a story with less than 1,000.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So.
And Stan knows it.
Yeah. So he and I are still going to duke that one out. But so what do you think is the most important thing to say about where you were and what you saw, what you experienced?
I mean, it changed my life.
Uh-huh.
It changed, actually, everyone who was involved with it, I think it changed their lives. I mean, I'm one of the lucky ones. It changed my life for the better. I wish it hadn't happened. But after the spill, I could have gone to work for the state or I could have gone to work for Exxon, but I chose to stay in Cordova and stay with the fishermen. I was executive director for 5 years, which in that job is a pretty long time. I think previous to that, people, you know, maybe a couple of years, but it certainly has, you know, taught me a lot and gave me a lot of experiences I never would have had any other way. And it's helped my career. Yes, in some ways, sometimes I feel a little guilty about that, but
survivors.
Because I mean, so many of my friends, did so much damage to their lives, but I think in some way everyone who was involved with it was changed. I mean, and I think a common thing I know I do myself, and I hear other people who were involved with it to do. You talk about before the spill and after the spill.
Yeah,
and there is such a dividing line there.
Yeah,
and in some ways, you know, it's so much better today than in a lot of ways it's so much better than it was then, but. But there's still so much that is unresolved, and mm-hmm. And of course, having the litigation still hanging out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hear people say, "Well, those fishermen, they just need to get over it." Well,
tell a parent to get over the death of their child.
Well, not only that, but also with that litigation going on, you can't get past it.
Right.
You know, it's not over with yet.
Right, and even if it does end. Finally, and in fact, you know, it's a gaping wound.
Yeah.
And then there's still the fishery. I mean, what impact ultimately does it have on the fishing industry?
Well, and the herring fishery still is.
Right.
Who knows? Who would have believed, on March 25th, 1989, that we'd be 18 years out and not have a herring fishery?
Yeah, I know. That's just... Yeah, it's in the category of the unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let me see if I need to change the tape on this. I've made that error more than once.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm sure you haven't noticed, but right behind you, there's a picture of the blockade up there on the top.
Oh! Yeah, that's wild. I think somebody ought to write a book about that.
Yeah, I was in Washington D.C. when that actually happened. Now, you know I moved to Washington, D.C. I lived in D.C. for 2.5 years.
No.
Yeah. Well, when I was on the original board of the RCAC.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the founders. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it really started in Cordova with a couple fishermen, you know, approaching the Alaska president, and Jim Hermiller, and he thought it was a good idea, too, and we proceeded to organize this thing. So I was on the board for a couple of years.
Wow. I'll want to ask some questions about that. But.
And then I had just gotten off the board, and at that time the then president and then executive director approached me because they had been contacted by Admiral Henn at the Coast Guard, and they wanted to borrow an employee to help them write oil spill regulations. And so they offered me a job, and I became an employee of RCAC, but there is a program called IPA, it's Intergovernmental Personnel Act, and federal agencies can borrow employees from other governmental agencies or qualified nonprofits, and RCAC was a qualified nonprofit. So I went to Washington, D.C., and I originally went for a year, but they kept on extending it. I ended up being there for 2.5 years. And I was on what's called the OPA 90 staff at Coast Guard Headquarters, and Oil Pollution Act staff.
Oh,
so I was actually there helping write the regulations to implement.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Oh, it was fascinating. And,
yes.
And frankly, I mean, it was such a great opportunity. Now, I think of myself as being a pretty fair person, and I think industry people who deal with me in general would probably agree with that statement. But for us to have a person on the inside actually helping to write the regulations rather than being just on the outside making their comments after the fact and hoping that those comments make a difference. I mean, it was huge.
Right. It just makes me think of the juxtaposition of you there in Washington helping write those regs as opposed to being in Cordova at the beginning of the thing and Exxon saying, you guys go away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you say a couple of fishermen approached Jim Hermiller.
Yeah, Rick Steiner and Dave Greiner. David Grimes, I'm sorry. Rick Steiner and David Grimes.
Yeah, Rick Steiner's a guy. I keep trying to run him down. I'm supposed to see him sometime today, but he's not getting back to me. And so then the actual founding of the organization really just sprang from that idea.
Yes. And, you know, it also, it was not a new idea. The idea actually had been batted around in the early days, even before the pipeline was built, but it was rejected. And again, that's just what I'm told.
Yeah.
But in fact, I mean, there was precedent for it, because in Sullom Voe in Scotland, there is an organization, you know, very much like what the RCAC is, that we, in fact, to a large extent, patterned ourselves after them. There are some pretty significant differences, too, but that was where the idea came from. In fact, Jonathan Wills, who, I don't know if you've heard that name yet or not, but
no.
He was the editor of the Shetland Times, and it was actually kind of funny because in the earliest days, I mean, the phone was just ringing off the hook, and I mean, I was getting phone calls literally from all over the world, and I didn't even remember talking to Jonathan, but literally he shows up in my office one day from Scotland, and he shows up in Cordova, Alaska. Well, it turned out, based on the conversation that he and I had, he decided that he needed to come here. And so he went to his publisher, and the publisher said, well, I'll buy you an airline ticket, but beyond that, you're on your own. So he came to Cordova, and he's a great guy. He's quite a charming person. So he had no problem, you know, getting a lot of friends and having places to stay and things like that. So, but and he also, you know, he brought us word of this council in Scotland that oversees that facility, and that was more than 50% ownership by BP, which of course at the time of the spill, you know, was the same thing here in for TAPS. And so there was precedent with BP of doing that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's it.
I'm going to flip this tape over. So the concept of before the oil spill, and after the oil spill, I was thinking about that yesterday, that I was really glad that I got to Alaska when I did, which was in 1977, which I know is another banner year for Alaska in terms of the beginning of the pipeline. Right. But if I had gotten to Alaska after 1989, I would have been forever wondering, what was it really like before the oil spill? Because people always, in Homer, people talk about the oil spill as though it happened last week.
They do in Cordova, too. And I'll admit, even, I mean, when I get going on it, I probably do, too. It seems like it was last week. It is so hard to believe that it was as long ago as it was. I mean, I remember, a year after the spill, 5 years after the spill, and it's just right there below the surface, you know.
Yeah, I am so hopeful that this book turns out to be something that could be so compelling that it could actually inform a new generation.
Mm-hmm.
My children, ages 22 and 23, they might have some notion that it happened, but they don't have any education about it. My husband and I have been traveling outside quite a bit, and there was a fear at the time, as you know, about boycotting Exxon, and people,
I was never afraid of it.
Yeah, and
living in Washington, D.C., it's hard not to buy Exxon gas.
Yeah, well, when we travel, we still personally boycott Exxon, but it's tough to do when you're traveling through places like Wyoming and Utah, and one thing for sure is you no longer want to have that bumper sticker.
Yeah.
You better not have that bumper sticker in those places, or anything that says refuse illegal war or anything like that, because they're just not too happy about that. But I really believe that if people understood what actually happened, if it was conveyed to them in a way that you read a novel, you lay it down, and because you're going to come back, you can't wait to pick it back up. If just one thing came out of that book, which was a whole bunch more people boycotting Exxon, I just would think that, what more? What better thing?
Yeah.
That would be the best thing.
Yeah.
So that's my...
I travel outside of Alaska a lot, and it's not unusual to have people tell me, I've never bought their gas since.
Well, oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, I also thought it's not unusual for me to people say, really?
Yeah. Well, I thought you got paid off for that. I thought they paid you off for that every year.
Yeah.
Which I guess in some ways they do. I don't know. Because, the one thing that somebody will invariably say, if you talk about the oil spill long enough with somebody from outside, they will say, well, then why don't you people put your money where your mouth is and just start refusing the permanent fund? And that's a really frustrating opinion to rub up against. So, fortunately, it doesn't happen all that often.
Yeah.
You have to have real staying power to be in a conversation that long to take that turn. But, well, what else do you want to say, Marilyn? As you know, you're going to be seeing this in document form, and you take the red pen to it.
Yeah.
But so tell me what else you would like to say.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't thought about it until you specified, that it was a life-changing event, and in your case, it changed it personally in positive ways, as opposed to friends for whom it took a negative turn. But that seems to be one commonality, is that it changed everybody's life. Would a similar event do the same thing, you think?
I mean, it's hard to say, but I mean, yeah, I think, actually, yeah, I think it probably would, and here's why, is because Cordova has changed so much since the spill. I mean, a lot of, even though I still have a lot of friends there, I was just there 2 weeks ago, and in a lot of ways, I still consider myself much more a Cordovan than an Anchorageite. A lot of the people that made Cordova what I liked about Cordova just frankly aren't even there anymore. There's been a lot of changeover. And because of that, I think if it were to happen again, you would have new people who didn't experience it before experiencing it. So I think for that reason, yeah, it probably would.
Okay, I'm going to stop here.
Okay.
Good?